Hello, and welcome back to this episode of Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about A Man for All Seasons by Robert Bolt, a play written in 1960 about the martyrdom of Sir Thomas More back during the Tudor period. So if we're going to be talking history, what better thing to do than bring in the history bro himself, Bo? How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for having me. I love talking about the age of Henry.
Yeah.
Love talking about Thomas More, Thomas Cromwell, Wolsey, the whole lot.
Right.
So, and it covers it, doesn't it? It's a great little bit of time.
It is.
The rise and, more importantly, the fall of Thomas More.
Mm.
St. Thomas More.
Yeah, if you're of that faith.
Yeah.
And, because we've actually talked about all of this a little bit before, but from a different viewpoint, haven't we? Because, well, you invited me in before I joined full-time, and we did that epoch on Thomas Cromwell, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the main way that we framed that discussion was looking at whether or not Cromwell as a man, the historical Cromwell, was more like his Wolf Hall portrayal or his A Man for All Seasons portrayal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So now we're just really going to focus in on this as a play and famously a fantastic film as well, the 1966 film, starring Paul Scofield, Robert Shaw.
Robert Shaw.
John
Hurt.
He
steals it.
Yeah.
Robert Shaw steals it as
one
Henry,
scene,
doesn't he?
And
yeah.
He's like, yeah.
It's brilliant portrayal.
Yeah. John Hurt. Yeah. Susanna York. Brilliant. Brilliant cast. So, let's...
And there's a late 80s Charlton Heston TV, I think it's for TV version, which I only discovered a couple of days ago.
Right.
I went on YouTube and saw that there was a full Man for All Seasons.
Oh.
I was like, oh, great. Well, I'll rewatch it then. I mean, I've watched the original Paul Scofield. I had it on VHS growing up, so I must have seen it 15 times, loads of times. It's a great, 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 great film.
Right.
And I saw on YouTube that the whole Man for All Seasons was on there. I was like, oh, okay. Oh, 2 hours and 20. It's a bit longer than I thought. Put it on, start watching it. It's like, Charlton Heston? Charlton Heston's not in it. And anyway... There's another TV version which I watched, which is interesting.
And you said it was pretty good.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's fairly low budget. It's not as good as the 1966 film. It's nowhere near as good, really. But it's definitely worth. It's still good, and it's still worth watching. The guy they got to play Henry is no Robert Shaw.
No.
But no, it's worth watching. It's a bit longer than the TV than the film, the 60s film. But yeah, anyway. That exists, which I didn't know until just a couple of days ago.
So there you are. If you want to watch that on YouTube, you can. And also, just to say as well, from what Bo tells me of it, because I've not seen that, it sounds to me like that version is a more faithful adaptation of the version that was made for theatre, that was written for theatre originally in this 1960 version, the way that it sounds like the common man speaks directly to the audience, the fact that it's got Chapuis in it, the ambassador who's absent from the 66 film.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It seems like the 66 film is abridged.
Yes.
A bit.
It's good, though. It's I like
but not much.
The leanness.
Yeah.
It's very...
Yeah. It's tight.
Yeah, it's tight. It's slick on wheels. Yeah. So let's just, before we talk about the play, as always, let's just talk a bit about Robert Bolt.
Okay.
Himself.
I don't know anything about himself. Should be learning here.
Yeah, okay. So, interesting. He was born in Sale in Manchester.
Okay.
In 1924.
That's unfortunate.
You're right, right, yeah. What a time and place to be dropped in, and that's where you're getting your start in life. So his dad was a furniture dealer. Right, so very, very ordinary background, very old, just some Manchester grammar school, and went on to work in an insurance company. And then the war broke out. And then he was in, and unlike what we did with the Master and Commander, I'm not whiplashing you with this. None of this is lies. This is all true. World War II, he was in he tried for the Air Force, but he was, got sickness, like he just couldn't take it from the flying, so he never got past that. And then he went on to be in it was called the Royal West Africa Frontier Force, which I don't know any great details about his time there doing it, but that's who he was with for the duration of World War II. Another interesting, and I'd be remiss not to mention it, part of his life during those years was that in 1942, he joined the Communist Party of Britain, right? So, oof, it's not great.
Yeah.
It's not great. I will say that he later repented.
Oh, all right.
And saw the error of his ways and realised that, hang on, this isn't really about freedom at all. And, yeah, he became quite a critic of it.
Oh, well, fair enough.
But, yeah, that was, you know, in his days of youth when he was idealistic and wrong.
I had a post of Che Guevara on my bedroom wall when I was, like, 15.
I can't even imagine that.
What a cliche as well.
I can't even imagine.
What a ridiculous cliche.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway.
You see, I never had that. I was just like voting UKIP from 18 as soon as I could.
Well, to be fair, to excuse myself, I didn't know anything really about Che Guevara. It was like...
Yeah.
It was just like when you're 15, you don't know shit, really.
Sure.
It's like having a Ban the Bomb poster.
Mm.
It was just a cool, clichéd poster to have. I didn't know anything about his life or his politics.
Sure, yeah.
But okay. There you go.
Yeah, we pardon you.
Many people, when they're young, are lefty.
Yeah, yeah, right, of course, yeah, yeah. Even Peter Hitchens. And so you have this... but then what's remarkable as well is that other than A Man for All Seasons, which is by far and away his most famous play, he also, of course, wrote the screenplay for David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, right,
yeah. That was him. He wrote the screenplay for that.
Right. Yeah.
He also wrote a screenplay for David Lean's Dr. Zhivago.
Okay, didn't know that.
And then a few decades later, he wrote the screenplay for The Bounty with Anthony Hopkins. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Back, so,
did he do the screenplay for the 66 film? Because he definitely did
the
88 Charlton Heston one.
Yes.
So, okay.
Yes, he amended it and went back and remodeled it. He won an Oscar, in fact, for Best Adapted Screenplay.
He did, didn't he? Yeah.
So, yeah, remarkable talent. Like, genuinely an incredible writer, and that's obviously something that we'll talk about more as it goes on, how well he seems to be able to just realise these characters. But also, one of the things as well, because I... just take an example off the top of my head. Like Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven. I really detest that film because it feels... They don't feel... like they're living in the 12th century. They feel too modern to be living in there. They say things that you just don't believe someone in the late 1100s would say.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, I don't feel like there's really any anachronisms. Like they feel really authentic, I think, to the time that they're living in.
Mm.
So,
no, it's brilliantly written. There's just no doubt about that, right? It's whatever that magic is, which makes you suspend your disbelief, and you believe the characters, you believe the scene that they're in. Whatever that magic is, he's got it. There's a reason why we're talking about this because it is so good.
So I suppose before we start the play as well, just why has he written the play about Sir Thomas More? Like, why? And it seems that actually More was a person who fascinated him from quite a young age. He seems to have been quite fascinated from More since his teenage years by his stand, his principle, his conscience, and all of the things that he obviously presents as being just remarkable testaments to More's character within this play. And so it's clear that this is something of a passion project for him.
Mm.
And he's been wanting to tell More's story for quite a long time. And I had an interesting quote from Bolt here where he said, "I'm not a Catholic, nor am I even in the meaningful sense of the word a Christian. So by what right do I appropriate a Christian saint to my purposes? Or to put it another way, why do I take as my hero a man who brings about his own death because he can't put his hand on an old black book and tell an ordinary lie? For this reason, a man takes an oath only when he wants to commit himself quite exceptionally to the statement. When he wants to make an identity between the truth of it and his own virtue, he offers himself as a guarantee. And it works."
Very good.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting to me because it's funny, I've never heard that quote before, but I feel exactly the same.
Mm.
I'm not a Catholic, and by no meaningful sense a Christian, though raised in the Christian milieu. And yet I deeply admire Thomas More.
Me too.
This, the story of Thomas More's downfall, certainly, and the story of A Man Full Seasons, is really a story of a man drawing a line in the sand. That's what it is. Unto death. Yes. And that's admirable.
Yeah,
to me, that's admirable. I even wrote an article for Load Seaters, if you can find it on the website, all about this. And it got a little bit of flack from some Catholics, but they obviously didn't read it or didn't understand what I was saying or something, even though it's pretty straightforward. They thought I was besmirching Catholicism in some way. It wasn't at all. Anyway, point is that, you don't really necessarily have to be Catholic to admire St. Thomas More. It's really the story of someone that's got, as I say, a line in the sand. There's a line which they will not be forced to cross, and that they've got. There's a number of ways of putting it, isn't there? But they've just got their own sense of right and wrong, and beyond a certain point, will not be coerced, will not be forced to do something or say something against their will.
When all the powers in the kingdom,
the whole world is against you.
Yeah.
And your life is on the line, not just your liberty, but your very life depends on it.
Mm.
I mean, we know he got his head cut off, but he could have been burnt.
Yeah.
Which is much worse, much, much worse.
Oh, yes.
Fate. So to have all that on the line and just in and of yourself, you say no. You say no, here is where I stand, like Luther.
Mm.
Here I stand, I can do no other. Let the heavens fall. Do what you will to me. But this is my line in the sand. I think that's absolutely admirable.
I entirely agree with you. And though I don't want to make too many allusions to our own times, you know, it is remarkable now when you just think of the fact that Thomas More just lost his life because he refused to take an oath. And now here, you know, you have the king taking a coronation oath and just not really fulfilling it. You have an MP in Parliament, who also, you know, you're supposed to swear allegiance to the king, and you have something like Clive Lewis, you know, where he had that thing. I know, but I'm just making the point that it's like,
no, it's a great point. No, I'm wincing at Clive Lewis.
Yeah. Oh well, yeah.
Being such a scumbag.
Well, wince away. But the point is, right, it's like, oh, I'm not saying it properly. It's like, then you just have to retake it again. So they made him retake it, and he just did it. It's like, yeah, but the point is, right, we know you're just lying.
Mm.
There's no force behind it. There's no consequence for you if you break this oath.
Mm.
There's no grander repercussion, no cosmic justice, you know. And so it's like, we've actually entered, we still have the concept of the oath, but it's form without force, right? It's hollow. It's just an age of hollow oaths now. It's
a man that's got a conscience and really means it.
Mm.
Like really means it. Almost like there's nothing else of importance other than your word.
Yeah.
What else is there other than the integrity of your word?
Yes.
Right?
Right.
It's interesting, just a brief aside, I was reading a bit and watching a bit about Enoch Powell recently, and there's one point in the early 70s when he refused to stand for the Conservatives anymore because everyone knew his thoughts and feelings were diametrically opposed to the government.
Mm.
And so he felt he could not stand because he would be a hypocrite and everyone would know it.
Yeah.
And he did an interview with William Buckley, Bill Buckley.
Mm.
And he said, Bill Buckley said, couldn't you just, for the whole campaign season of 3 weeks leading up to the general election, why couldn't you just sort of go on holiday to South America or something so that you were never asked these questions, so that you were just, you physically never had to say contradictory, hypocritical things.
Mm.
And Enoch Powell said, no, that's no good. That's just ridiculous, absurd cowardice. No, that's not good enough.
Absolutely.
Again, the same sort of principle. No, I'll stand on my principles.
Mm.
And again, I can do no other.
Yes.
And
it's what separates more as a person from the other people of his age.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
From the other people of his age.
Yeah.
So let's start talking about the play itself. So one thing to mention is that differences with the 66 film and this is that the film is, of course, being a piece of cinema, is all acted much more naturalistically, right? It's all about just immersion in the time period, in the characters, in Moore's struggle, the emotional toll it's taking on him, the sacrifices that he's making, how it affects his family, all these sorts of things. And that is absolutely there in the play itself. However, the play has, because it leans more into the common man character who works as a framing device, you have this...
Matthew.
Well, he's Matthew when he is Moore's steward. And then at other times, that actor will play the boatman.
Right, yeah.
Or the jailer. Yeah, or yeah. whatever it may yeah, be. So right. he hops about. And you know, he just plays all of the characters that the lower orders right. would have had back then. So he's... I mean, Bolt talks about in the preface to this how that character came to be mistaken for just sort of representing the man on the street when really what Bolt was trying to communicate was there was something about that character that is supposed to represent something common about all of humanity. Just the questions that he asks about things he gets you to think about. And because at the time when Bolt was writing this play in about 1960, you were having, there was quite a burst of creativity in England, English theatre, because of a German playwright known as Bertolt Brecht, who you may or may not be familiar with.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and he had this theatrical device known as, what is it called? Alienation. And so rather than you be, like a film, immersed in the action, you rather were to be constantly reminded that this is a play. Mm. And it was... I mean, this is a more tepid form of it, but it's about asking you questions and then getting you to think critically all the time about the things that you're being presented with,
right.
as opposed to just getting sort of whipped away in the struggles of one man.
Yeah.
But to that extent, I don't think the play, I don't think it makes it a better play in any way. Like it's, but it's just something I thought was worth mentioning for people at home to give them just a full picture of something that's in the play.
It reminds me of the chorus you might get in an older play or an ancient play.
Sure.
Or even in Shakespeare, I think of Henry V. Henry V has a chorus in it where, you know, it's very much making you aware that you're watching a play. It's like, come and join me. Use your imagination to pretend, like literally saying this.
Right.
Imagine this stage is the vasty fields of France. Imagine that there's 1,000 horses behind me and stuff like
I'm
that.
There.
Yeah.
I'm there. Yeah.
So there's that Matthew character or that everyman sort of character acts as a sort of a chorus.
Sure.
Opening a lot of the scenes. Or at the very beginning of the play, saying, oh, look, here comes Thomas More. Mm. Oh, look, here comes the Duke of Norfolk.
Yeah.
Oh, look, that's Thomas More's wife.
Yeah.
You know, like quite literally saying,
yes.
You know, so, which takes you out of it a bit.
Yeah.
Like that's not done in modern films at all.
No.
But it is a play. And so.
Mm. You can get away with different things in the theatre.
Right. Yeah.
So the first scene, we get, we're introduced to Thomas More. In his home with his family, right? So you have Thomas, you have his wife, Alice, and though he had many children, the play just focuses on his daughter, Margaret.
Yeah, his favourite, I think.
Yeah, his favourite, yeah. And the play does a really good job of showing that. Well, I suppose it does. Like, if she's the only child in the play, then that is sort of a favourite, I suppose, but not much to compare to. But yeah, but she's... and. It's fantastic because Alice is a very straightforward woman. She's not educated. Mm. She can't read. She can't write.
Yeah.
And in fact, she scoffs at the idea of learning. She's asked, do you want me to teach you? No. You know, whereas Meg is incredibly academic. And you can tell that Moore is bringing her up to be a very, very educated woman. And also, you have the Duke of Norfolk, one of the most powerful nobleman in the realm, and you also have the character of Richard Rich. So you're immediately introduced to a whole series of characters, and they all have their own particular colour to them. They're all, and one of the things in particular, I love the Duke of Norfolk because everything that he says, he just owns the room, right? You know, because he has that nobility about him, the conversation is what the Duke of Norfolk wants to talk about. The Duke of Norfolk goes where the Duke of Norfolk wants to go. And when you compare that with the character immediately, like Richard, who is very meek, and, oh, I read this thing in Aristotle, and then he just trails off. You know, he's just constantly trailing off. He's not sure in his own sense of self. And this idea of your own sense of self is something that the play constantly refers back to.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.